Also, releasing a few prisoners soon would give some hope to the rest of them and relieve some of their feelings of desperation. The consensus seems to be to release the first prisoner soon, Big Jim, 4325, and then number 3, Rich, 1037, later on, perhaps replacing them with other standby prisoners. There are mixed feelings about whether 3401 or 7258 should be released next, or at all. What have we witnessed here? Three general themes emerge from the first parole board hearings. The boundaries between simulation and reality have been blurred. The prisoner's subservience and seriousness has steadily increased in response to the guard's ever greater domination, and there has been a dramatic character transformation in the performance of the parole board head, Carlo Prescott. Blurring the line between the prison experiment and the reality of imprisonment. Impartial observers not knowing what had preceded this event might readily assume that they were witnessing an actual hearing of a local prison parole board in action. The strength and manifest reality of the dialectic at work between those imprisoned and society's appointed guardians of them was reflected in many ways, among them the overall seriousness of the situation, the formality of the parole requests by inmates, the opposing challenges from their guards, the diverse composition of all the parole board members, the nature of the personal questions put to the inmates, and accusations made against them. In short, the intense effective quality of the entire proceeding. The basis of this interaction is obvious in the board's questions and prisoners' answers regarding past convictions, the rehabilitative activities of attending classes or participating in therapy or vocational training sessions, arranging for legal representation, the status of their trial, and their future plans for becoming good citizens. It is as hard to realize that barely 4 days have passed in the lives of these student experimental volunteers as it is to imagine that their future as prisoners is little more than another week in the Stanford County Jail. Their captivity is not the many months or long years that the mock parole board seems to imply in its judgments. Role-playing has become role internalization. The actors have assumed the characters and identities of their fictional roles. The prisoner's subservience and seriousness. By this point, for the most part, the prisoners have slipped reluctantly but finally compliantly into their highly structured roles in our prison. They refer to themselves by their identification numbers and answer immediately to questions put to their anonymous identities. They answer what should be ridiculous questions with full seriousness. For example, inquiries into the nature of their crimes and their rehabilitation efforts. With few exceptions, they have become completely subservient to the authority of the parole board, as well as to the domination of the correctional officers and the system in general. Only prisoner 7258 had the temerity to refer to his reason for being here as volunteering for an experiment, but he quickly backed away from that assertion under Prescott's verbal assaults. The flippant style of some of their original parole requests, notably that of prisoner 3401, the Asian American student, withers under the negative judgment of the board that such unacceptable behavior does not warrant release. Most of the prisoners seem to have completely accepted the premises of the situation. They no longer object to or rebel against anything they are told or commanded to do. They are like method actors who continue to play their roles when offstage and off camera, and their role has come to consume their identity. It must be distressing to those who argue for innate human dignity to note the servility of the former prisoner rebels, the heroes of the uprisings, who have been reduced to beggars. No heroes are stepping out from this aggregation. That feisty Asian American prisoner, Glenn, 3401, had to be released some hours after his stressful parole board experience, when he developed a full-body rash. Student health services provided the appropriate medication, and he was sent home to consult his own physician. The rash was his body's way of getting his release, as was Doug 8612's raging loss of emotional control. the dramatic transformation of the parole board head. I had known Carlo Prescott for more than 3 months before this event and had interacted with him almost daily in person and in frequent and long phone calls. As we co-taught a six-week-long course on the psychology of imprisonment, I had seen him in action as an eloquent, vehement critic of the prison system, which he judged to be a fascist tool designed to oppress people of color. He was remarkably perceptive in the ways in which prisons and all other authoritarian systems of control can change all those in their grip, both the imprisoned and their imprisoners. Indeed, during his Saturday evening talk show program on the local radio station KGO, Carlo frequently made his listeners aware of the failure of this antiquated, expensive institution that their tax dollars were wasted in continuing to support. He had told me of the nightmares he would have anticipating the annual parole board hearings, in which an inmate has only a few minutes to present his appeal to several board members, who do not seem to be paying any attention to him as they thumb through fat files while he pleads his case. Perhaps some of the files are not even his, but are those of the next prisoner in line, and reading them now will save time. If you are asked questions about your conviction or anything negative in your rap sheet, you know immediately that parole will be delayed for at least another year because defending the past prevents you from envisioning anything positive in your future. Carlo's tales enlightened me about the kind of rage that such arbitrary indifference generates in the vast majority of prisoners who are denied parole year after year, as he was. However, what are the deeper lessons to be learned from such situations? Admire power, detest weakness. Dominate, don't negotiate. Hit first when they turn the other cheek. The golden rule is for them, not for us. Authority rules, rules are authority. These are also some of the lessons learned by boys of abusive fathers, half of whom are transformed into abusive fathers themselves, abusing their children, spouses, and parents. Perhaps half of them identify with the aggressor and perpetuate his violence, while the others learn to identify with the abused and reject aggression for compassion. However, research does not help us to predict which abused kids will later become abusers and which will turn out to be compassionate adults. Time out for a demonstration of power without compassion. I am reminded of the classic demonstration by an elementary school teacher, Jane Elliott, who taught her students the nature of prejudice and discrimination by arbitrarily relating the eye color of children in her classroom to high or low status. When those with blue eyes were associated with privilege, they readily assumed a dominant role over their brown-eyed peers, even abusing them verbally and physically. Moreover, their newly acquired status spilled over to enhance their cognitive functioning. When they were on top, the blue eyes improved their daily math and spelling performances. Statistically significant, as I documented with Elliot's original class data. Just as dramatically, test performance of the inferior brown-eyed children deteriorated. However, the most brilliant aspect of her classroom demonstration with these third-grade schoolchildren from Riceville, Iowa, was the status reversal the teacher generated the next day. Mrs. Elliott told the class she had erred. In fact, the opposite was true, she said. Brown eyes were better than blue eyes. Here was the chance for the brown-eyed children, who had experienced the negative impact of being discriminated against, to show compassion now that they were on top of the heap. The new test scores reversed the superior performance of the haves and diminished the performance of the have-nots. But what about the lesson of compassion? Did the newly elevated brown eyes understand the pain of the underdog, of those less fortunate, of those in a position of inferiority that they had personally experienced one brief day earlier? There was no carryover at all. The brown eyes gave what they got. They dominated, they discriminated, and they abused their former blue-eyed abusers. Similarly, history is filled with accounts showing that many of those escaping religious persecution show intolerance of people of other religions once they are safe and secure in their new power domain. Back to brown-eyed Carlo. This is a long side trip around the issues surrounding my colleague's dramatic transformation when he was put into the powerful position as head of the parole board. At first, he gave a truly outstanding improvisational performance, like a Charlie Parker solo. He improvised details of crimes of the prisoners' past histories, on the spot, out of the blue. He did so without hesitation, with a fluid certainty. However, as time wore on, he seemed to embrace his new authority role with ever-increasing intensity and conviction. He was the head of the Stanford County Jail Parole Board, the authority whom inmates suddenly feared, to whom his peers deferred. Forgotten were the years of suffering he had endured as a brown-eyed inmate once he was granted the privileged position of seeing the world through the eyes of the all-powerful head of this board. Carlo's statement to his colleagues at the end of this meeting showed the agony and disgust his transformation had instilled in him. He had become the oppressor. Later that night, over dinner, he confided that he had been sickened by what he had heard himself say and had felt when he was cloaked in his new role. I wondered if his reflections would cause him to show the positive effects of his acquired self-knowledge when he headed the next parole board meeting on Thursday. Would he show greater consideration and compassion for the new set of prisoners who would be pleading to him for parole? Or would the role remake the man? Thursday's meeting of the Parole and Disciplinary Board. The next day brings four more prisoners before a reconstituted parole board. Except for Carlo, all the other members of the board are newcomers. Craig Haney, who had to leave town for urgent family business in Philadelphia, is replaced by another social psychologist, Christina Maslach, who quietly observes the proceedings with little apparent direct involvement, at this time. A secretary and two graduate students fill out the rest of this five-person board. However, at the urging of the guards, in addition to considering parole requests, the board also considers various disciplinary actions against the more serious troublemakers. Kurt Banks continues in his role as sergeant-at-arms, and Warden David Jaffe also sits in to observe and comment when appropriate. Again, I watch from behind the one-way viewing screen and record the proceedings for subsequent analysis on our Ampex video recorder. Another variation from yesterday is that we do not have the prisoners sit around the same table with the board, but separately in high chairs, on a pedestal, so to speak. All the better to observe them as in police detective interrogations. A hunger striker strikes out. First up on the docket is prisoner 416, recently admitted, who is still on a hunger strike. Kurt Banks reads off the disciplinary charges that several guards have filed against him. Guard Arnett is especially angered at 416. He and the other guards are not sure what to make of him.
Here for a short time, and he has been totally recalcitrant, disrupting all order and our routine.
The prisoner immediately agrees that they are right. He will not dispute any of the charges. He insists on securing legal representation before he consents to eat anything served him in this prison. Prescott goes after his demand for legal aid, forcing a clarification. Prisoner 416 replies in a strange fashion. I'm in prison for all practical purposes because I signed a contract, which I'm not of legal age to sign. In other words, either we must get a lawyer to take his case and get him released, or he will continue with his hunger strike and get sick. Thus, he reasons, the prison authorities will be forced to release him. This scrawny youngster presents much the same face to the board that he does to the guards. He is intelligent, self-determined, and strong-willed in his opinions. However, his justification for disputing his imprisonment, that he was not of legal age to sign the research-informed consent contract, seems strangely legalistic and circumstantial for a person who has typically acted from ideological principles. Despite his disheveled, gaunt appearance, there is something about 416's demeanor that does not elicit sympathy from anyone who interacts with him.
neither the guards, the other prisoners, nor this board. He looks like a homeless street person who makes passersby feel more guilty than sympathetic. When Prescott asks on what charge 416 is in jail for, the prisoner responds, "There is no charge. I've not been charged. I was not arrested by the Palo Alto police." Incensed, Prescott asks if 416 is in jail by mistake then. "I was a standby. I..." Prescott is fuming now and confused. I realize that I had not briefed him on how 416 differed from all the others as a newly admitted standby prisoner. "What are you, anyway, a philosophy major?" Carlo takes time to light his cigarette and perhaps plan a new line of attack. "You've been philosophizing since you've been in here." When one of the secretaries on today's board recommends exercise as a form of disciplinary action, and 416 complains that he has been forced to undergo too much exercise, Prescott curtly replies, "He looks like a strong fellow. I think exercise would be ideal for him." He looks over at Kurt and Jaffe to put that on their action list. Finally, when asked the loaded question, would he be willing to forfeit all the money he has earned as a prisoner if a parole were granted, 416 immediately and defiantly replies, "Yes, of course, because I don't feel that the money is worth the time." Carlos has had enough of him. "Take him away." 416 then does exactly what the others before him have done, like automatons. Without instruction, he stands up, arms outstretched to be handcuffed, head bagged, and escorted away from these proceedings. Curiously, he does not demand that the board act now to terminate his role as a reluctant student research volunteer. He doesn't want any money, so why does he not simply say, "I quit this experiment. You must give me my clothes and belongings, and I'm out of here." The prisoner's first name is Clay, but he will not be molded easily by anyone. He stands firmly by his principles and obstinately in the strategy he has advanced. Nevertheless, he has become too embedded in his prisoner identity to do the macro analysis that should tell him he has now been given the keys to freedom by insisting to the parole board that he must be allowed to quit here and now while he is physically removed from the prisoner venue. However, he is now carrying that venue within his head. Addicts are easy game. Prisoner Paul, 5704, next at bat, immediately complains about how he's missing the cigarette ration that he was promised for good behavior. His disciplinary charges by the guards include constantly and grossly insubordinate, with flares of violence and dark mood, and constantly tries to incite the other prisoners to insubordination and general uncooperativeness. Prescott challenges his so-called good behavior, which will never get him another cigarette again. The prisoner answers in such a barely audible voice that board members have to ask him to speak louder. When he is told that he acts badly, even when he knows it will mean punishment for other prisoners, he again mumbles, staring toward the center of the table. "We've discussed that. Well, if something happens, we're just going to follow through with it. If someone else was doing something, I'd go through punishment for them." A board member interrupts. "Have you gone through punishment for any of the other prisoners?" Paul, 5704, responds, "Yes, he has suffered for his comrades." Prescott loudly and mockingly declares, "You're a martyr then, huh?" "Well, I guess we all are," 5704 says, again barely audible. "What have you got to say for yourself?" Prescott demands. 5704 responds, but again it is unintelligible. Recall that 5704, the tallest prisoner, had challenged many of the guards openly and been the insider in various escape attempts, rumors, and barricades. He was also the one who had written to his girlfriend, expressing his pride at being elected head of the Stanford County Jail Prisoners Grievance Committee. Further, it was this same 5704 who had volunteered for this experiment under false pretenses. He signed up with the intention of being a spy who was going to expose this research in articles he planned to write for several alternative liberal underground newspapers, on the assumption that this experiment was no more than a government-supported project for learning how to deal with political dissidents. Where had all that former bravado gone? Why had he suddenly become incoherent? Before us in this room sits a subdued, depressed young man. Prisoner 5704 simply stares downward, nodding answers to the questions posed by the parole board, never making direct eye contact.
"Yes, I would be willing to give up any pay I've earned to get paroled now, sir,"
he answers as loudly as he can muster strength to do. The tally is now yes from 5 of the 6 prisoners. I wonder how that dynamic, passionate, revolutionary spirit, so admirable in this young man, could have vanished so totally in such a short time. As an aside, we later learned that it was Paul, 5704, who had gotten so deeply into his prisoner role that, as the first part of his escape plan, he had used his long, hard guitar-playing fingernails to unscrew one of the electrical power plates from the wall. He then used that plate to help remove the doorknob on his cell. He also used those tough nails to mark on the wall of his cell the passage of days of his confinement, with notches next to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, so far. A puzzling, powerful prisoner. The next parole request comes from prisoner Jerry, 5486. He is even more puzzling than those who appeared earlier. He shows an upbeat style, a sense of being able to cope quietly with whatever is coming his way. His physical robustness is in stark contrast to that of prisoner 416 or some of the other slim prisoners, like Glenn, 3401. Surely there is the sense that he will endure the full 2 weeks without complaint. However, there is an insincerity in his statements, and he has shown little overt support for any of his comrades in distress. In a few minutes here, 5486 manages to antagonize Prescott as much as any other prisoner has. He answers immediately that he would not be willing to give up the pay he's earned so far in exchange for parole. The guards report that 5486 does not deserve parole consideration because he made a joke out of letter writing and for his general non-cooperation. When asked to explain his action, prisoner 5486 responds that, "I knew it wasn't a legitimate letter. It didn't seem to be." Guard Arnett, who has been standing aside silently observing the proceedings, can't help but interrupt. "Did the correctional officers ask you to write the letter?" 5486 responds affirmatively, as Guard Arnett continues. "And you're saying that the correctional officers asked you to write a letter that was not legitimate?" 5486 backtracks. "Well, maybe I chose the wrong word." But Arnett does not let up. He reads his report to the board. 5486 has been on a gradual downhill slide. He's become something of a jokester and minor cut-up." "You find that funny?" Carlo challenges him. "Everybody in the room was smiling. I wasn't smiling till they smiled," 5486 replies defensively. Carlo ominously interjects. "Everyone else can afford a smile. We're going home tonight." Still, he attempts to be less confrontational than the day before, and he asks a series of provocative questions. "If you were in my place, with the evidence I have, along with the report from staff, what would you do? How would you act? What would you do? What do you think is right for yourself?" The prisoner answers evasively, but never fully addresses those difficult questions. After a few more questions from the other members of the board, an exasperated Prescott dismisses him. "I think we've seen enough. I think we know what we need to do. I don't see any reason to waste our time." The prisoner is surprised at being dismissed so abruptly. It is apparent to him that he has created a bad impression on those he should have persuaded to support his cause, if not for this parole, then for the next time the board meets.
He has not acted in his best interests at this time. Kurt has the guard handcuff him, place the bag over his head, and sit him on the bench in the hallway, awaiting the disposition of the next and final case before the prisoners are hauled back downstairs to resume their prison life. Sarge's surface tension. The final inmate for the board to evaluate is Sarge, prisoner 2093, who, true to type, sits upright in the high chair, chest out, head back, chin tucked in, a perfect military posture if I've ever seen one. He requests parole so that he can put his time to more productive use, and he notes further that he has followed all rules from day one. Unlike most of his peers, 2093 would not give up the pay in exchange for parole. "Were I to give up the pay I've earned thus far, it would be an even greater loss of 5 days of my life than it would have been otherwise." He adds that the relatively small pay hardly compensates for the time he has served. Prescott goes after him for not sounding genuine, for having thought everything out in advance, for not being spontaneous, for using words to disguise his feelings. Sarge apologizes for giving that impression, because he always means what he says and tries hard to articulate clearly what he means. That softens Carlo, who assures Sarge that he and the board will consider his case very seriously, and then commends him for his good work in the prison. Before ending the interview, Carlo asks Sarge why he didn't request parole the first time it was offered to all prisoners. Sarge explains, "I would have requested parole the first time only if not enough other prisoners requested it." He felt that other prisoners were having a harder time in the prison than he was, and he didn't want his request to be placed above another's. Carlo gently rebukes him for this show of shining nobility, which he thinks is a crass attempt to influence the board's judgment. Sarge's show of surprise makes it evident that he meant what he said and was not attempting to impress the board or anyone else. This apparently intrigues Carlo, and he aims to learn about the young man's private life. Carlo asks about Sarge's family, his girlfriend, what kind of movies he likes, whether he takes time to buy an ice cream cone, all the little things that, taken together, give someone a unique identity. Sarge replies matter-of-factly that he doesn't have a girlfriend, seldom goes to movies, and that he likes ice cream but has not been able to afford to buy a cone recently. "All I can say is that after having gone to summer quarter at Stanford and living in the back of my car, I had a little difficulty sleeping the first night because the bed was too soft here in prison, and also that I've been eating better in prison than I had for the past 2 months, and that I had more time to relax than I had the last 2 months. Thank you, sir." Wow, what a violation of expectation this young man offers us. His sense of personal pride and stocky build belie his having gone hungry all summer and not having had a bed to sleep in while he attended summer school. That the horrid living conditions in our prison could be a better lifestyle for any college student comes as a shocker to us all. In one sense, Sarge seems to be the most one-dimensional, mindlessly obedient prisoner of all, yet he is the most logical, thoughtful, and morally consistent prisoner of the group. It occurs to me that one problem this young man might have stems from his commitment to living by abstract principles and not knowing how to live effectively with other people or how to ask others for the support he needs, financial, personal, and emotional. He seems so tightly strung by this inner resolve and his outer military posturing that no one can really get access to his feelings. He may end up having a harder life than the rest of his fellows. Contrition doesn't cut the mustard. Just as the board is preparing to end this session, Kurt announces that prisoner 5486, the flippant one, wants to make an additional statement to the board. Carlo nods okay. 5486 contritely says that he didn't express what he really wanted to say, because he hadn't had a chance to think about it fully. He's experienced a personal decline while in this prison,
because at first he expected to go to a trial, and now he's given up on his hope for justice. Guard Arnett, sitting behind him, relates a conversation they had during lunch today, in which 5486 said that his decline must have been because he's fallen in with bad company. Carlo Prescott and the board are obviously confused by this transaction. How does this statement promote his cause? Prescott is clearly upset at this display. He tells 5486 that if the board were going to make any recommendations, I would see to it personally that you were here until the last day. Nothing against you personally, but we're here to protect society, and I don't think that you can go out and do a constructive job, do the kinds of things that will make you an addition to the community. You went outside that door, and you realized that you had talked to us like we were a couple of idiots, and you were dealing with cops or authority figures. You don't get along well with authority figures, do you? How do you get along with your folks? But what I'm trying to say is that you went outside the door and had a little time to think. Now you're back in here trying to con us into looking at you with a different view. What real social consciousness do you have? What do you think you really owe society? I want to hear something real from you. Carlo is back in day one form. The prisoner is taken aback by this frontal assault on his character, and he scurries to make amends. I have a new teaching job. It's a worthwhile job, I feel. Prescott is not buying his story. That may even make you more suspect. I don't think I'd want you to teach any of my youngsters. Not with your attitude, your gross immaturity, your indifference to responsibility. You can't even handle 4 days of prison without making yourself a nuisance. Then you tell me that you want to do a teaching job, do something that's really a privilege. It's a privilege to come into contact with decent people and have something to say to them. I don't know. You haven't convinced me. I just read your record for the first time, and you haven't showed me anything. Officer, take him away. Chained, bagged, and carted back down to the basement prison, the prisoner will have to put on a better show at the next parole hearing, assuming he is granted the privilege again. When a paroled prisoner becomes the chairman of the parole board. Before we return to what has been happening down below on the yard in our absence during these two parole board timeaways, it is instructive to note the effect that this role-playing has had on our tough chairman of this adult authority hearing. A month later, Carlo Prescott offered a tender personal declaration of the impact this experience had on him. Whenever I came into the experiment, I invariably left with a feeling of depression. That's exactly how authentic it was. The experiment stopped being an experiment when people began to react to various kinds of things that happened during the course of the experiment. I noted in prison, for example, that people who considered themselves guards had to conduct themselves in a certain way. They had to put across certain impressions, certain attitudes. Prisoners in other ways had their certain attitudes, certain impressions that they acted out. The same thing occurred here. I can't begin to believe that an experiment permitted me, playing a board member, the chairman of the board, the adult authority board, to say to one of the prisoners, how is it, in the face of his arrogance and his defiant attitude, how is it that Orientals seldom come to prison, seldom find themselves in this kind of a situation? What did you do? It was at that particular point in the study that his whole orientation changed. He began to react to me as an individual. He began to talk to me about his personal feelings. One man was so completely involved that he came back into the room as if he thought a second journey into the room to speak to the Adult Authority Board could result in his being paroled sooner. Carlo continues with this self-disclosure. Well, as a former prisoner, I must admit that each time I came here, the friction, suspicion, the antagonism expressed as the men got into the roles made me recognize the kind of deflated impression which came about as a result of the confinement. That's exactly what it was that induced in me a deep feeling of depression,
as if I were back in a prison atmosphere. The whole thing was authentic, not make-believe at all. The prisoners were reacting as human beings to a situation, however improvisational, that had become part of what they were experiencing at that particular time. I imagine that as such, it reflected the kind of metamorphosis that takes place in a prisoner's thinking. After all, he is completely aware of the things that are going on in the external world. The bridge building, the birth of children, they have absolutely nothing to do with him. For the first time, he is totally alienated from the rest of society, from humanity for that matter. His fellows, in their funk and stink and their bitterness, become his comrades, and all other things except for an occasional period when he can, as a result of a visit, as a result of something happening, like going to the parole board, there's no reason to ever identify with where you came from. There is just that time, that instant. I wasn't surprised, nor was it a great pleasure to find my belief confirmed that people become the role they enact, that guards become symbols of authority and cannot be challenged, and that there are no rules or no rights they are obliged to grant prisoners. This happens with prison guards, and this happens with college students playing at prison guards. The prisoner, on the other hand, who is left to consider his own situation in regard to how defiant he is, how effective he is in keeping the experience away from him, comes face to face daily with his own helplessness. He has to correlate both his own hatred and the effectiveness of his defiance with the reality that regardless of how heroic or how courageous he sees himself at a certain time, he will still be counted and still be subjected to the rules and regulations of the prison. I think it is appropriate to end these deliberations with a similarly insightful passage from the letters of the political prisoner George Jackson, written a bit before Carlo's statement. Recall that his lawyer wanted me to be an expert witness in his defense in the upcoming Soledad Brothers trial. However, Jackson was killed before I could do so, one day after our study ended. It is strange indeed that a man can find anything to laugh at in here. Everyone is locked up 24 hours a day. They have no past, no future, no goal other than the next meal. They're afraid, confused, and confounded by a world they know that they did not make, that they feel they cannot change. So they make those loud noises, so they won't hear what their mind is trying to tell them. They laugh to assure themselves and those around them that they are not afraid, sort of like the superstitious individual who will whistle or sing a happy number as he passes the graveyard.